I want to, this morning, to begin with, to complete our discussion of Emerson, and in doing so, establish a bridge to William James. What I'm going to say to you about Emerson, I would need to say, even if I have not Emerson on the agenda, but only William James. Because to understand, to understand William James, one must go back to Emerson on the point that I'm about to make as a point of beginning for an understanding of James's pluralism. What I want to talk about is Emerson's view of evil, which is a problem that we've been concerned with in one way or another throughout the semester. Emerson believed that every evil is in the end utilized in some way for the advancement of good. That evil makes its unwilling contribution to good. This is Emerson's optimism, an aspect of Emerson which has been widely criticized and attacked. And particularly in more recent years, for us who have survived the Holocaust and the Nazi and fascist onslaughts on human rights and human beings. Emerson believed in the inevitability, and he meant that literally, the inevitability of the good winning out, and that evil only appears to be evil. There's an illusory character that evil has. He believed this, and we want to go into it, because James rebelled against this notion. And it's at the core of James's philosophy, his rebellion against Emerson on this point. Emerson believed in the inevitability of the good for a number of reasons. First, because of his belief in the infinite capacity of the human being, of the individual, and therefore the infinite capacity of mankind as a whole to make a better world. That he felt that evil should not and cannot be given the status of reality. Because if it were real, then Emerson would have had to find, like Hobbes, ways of restraining man. The restraints would stand in the way of the infinite capacity of the individual and of the species as a whole, the race. Secondly, Emerson believed in the religious tradition which held to the idea that God, as the Creator, was capable only of creating good. That it would be inconsistent, incongruous, and to him unthinkable to associate God in any way with evil. Evil, therefore, is somehow unreal. Every man, as we have seen, Emerson believed, is his own providence. As he makes his own life, and the law of compensation works in his life, and that is good. And in the same way, there is an overriding providence, a universal providence. God, who vetoes our individual evils and cancels them out. We think we do evil, and in a certain sense we do, but God has his own way of using what men do. And God, in his providence, overrides, vetoes our individual manipulations and our individual providences for a universal good. Thirdly, Emerson belonged to the classical philosophical tradition which posited the existence of the absolute with a capital A, or the whole with a capital W, or as he sometimes speaks of it, the oversoul. The all-encompassing totality, which we call the universe, which is one, and which is primarily spirit. This is why he speaks of it as the oversoul. Each man is a soul, but then there is an oversoul which encompasses the whole, encompasses the individual souls, of which each is only a part, a small fraction. And the oversoul will ultimately assimilate to its own good purposes all the individual purposes that are operative in the universe. In the essay on the oversoul, we live in succession, in division, in parts, in particles, as we live through seconds, minutes, hours, years, one thing seems to follow another. Everything seems to be broken up into small bits. Meantime, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. And this deep power in which we exist and whose beatitude is all accessible to us is not only self-sufficing and perfect in every hour, but the act of seeing and the thing seen, the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object are one. That is, I within myself comprehend the whole, the one. My soul comprehends the oversoul. I am a small part of the oversoul, but with the capacity to know that I'm only a small part of something that is infinite. And so the seer and the spectacle. The seer may be the one, I may be the spectacle, but then you can reverse the order because they are one. So I am the seer and the one is the spectacle. I can contemplate the one. I can contemplate the absolute. We see the world piece by piece as the sun, the moon, the animal, the tree. But the whole of which these are the shining parts is the soul. Only by the vision of that wisdom can the horoscope of the ages be read. Now, from this standpoint, each fact implies the whole of truth. And the whole of truth is God, or the Oversoul, or the Absolute. As if you take, Emerson might argue, as in the 19th century the idealists all argue this, say Hegel, Coleridge, Fichte, Schelling, if you take any small object, take a matchstick, if you think of it in the philosophic terms of the school of thought of which this is representative, this small piece of wood, of course, it's only a piece from a larger piece of timber. That was part of a tree. The tree's part of a forest. The tree's connected with the soil. The tree doesn't grow unless the sun and all of nature cooperates. There has to be rain. There have to be clouds and rain. There has to be the seasons. If you think long enough and try to spell out what is implied in this tiny little object, before long, you've constructed the whole universe that seems to have cooperated over the centuries, because the tree started from a seed. And the seed had to go back to another tree, to an earlier one. And so on, before long, you're back in the Garden of Eden, as it were. Same thing would be true of man. Leibniz, for example, argued, and this is a typical approach of the absolutist, that I was implied in the creation of Adam. Adam and Eve, they carry the seed which ultimately became me. And so the totality of man is implicated in my existence. I have only two parents. I had only two parents, but each of them had two parents. So that made four grandparents, but each of them had two parents. So you have eight great-grandparents, and you go back, and you go back. And millions of people are involved, countless people are involved in the creation of the single human being. Now, this is the absolutistic view of things. A thing by itself has no reality. It has a reality only when it is seen from the standpoint of the totality of the whole. Then you see it in its place, in its time, in its proper role, in its status. Otherwise, your view of what you see is no different from the view of what a dog sees or a cat sees, or the roles that Emerson spoke of in another context. It exists only in the present, which is another way, of course, of experiencing things. And one doesn't cancel the other. Emerson stood for both. But that was another way of looking at it. Don't abstract, but here he is abstracting, you see. The abstraction goes on to the point where the individual thing loses, from one point of view, its reality. From another point of view, becomes more real because it concretizes the whole universe. God, the absolute, as it were, comes to a focus in the individual man or in the individual object. Because from that point of view, there's no difference between a man and a bird or a matchstick. God is therefore in everything. God is only good. And God will not trifle or mislead us. He is not malicious. So there is no room for evil. That is, ultimately, evil has to get pushed out. Because the totality, which is God, or from the theistic point of view, which God has projected, when God made Adam and Eve, He in some way projected the totality of mankind. And when He first created the world, He projected the totality, which includes the present world or the universe as it is at this moment. But God couldn't have wanted evil to be part of that universe. In one way, it is the faith, of course, that Job expressed, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." As my being slain cannot ultimately be an evil, because the kind of God in whom I trust wouldn't allow the slaying of me to be an evil. Because if it were, then I couldn't trust him. But I do trust him. And I can trust only a God to whom the slaying of me would not be an evil. It is no different from the thoughts that went through the mind, as we know, of Thomas More, for example, when he stood on the execution block. He couldn't have thought of his execution as being an evil, because the God for whom he was dying, for whose commandment he was dying, couldn't be a God who wouldn't make use of his execution for his own good purposes. Thomas More didn't know what God's purposes were, but he trusted him. And that is why he was willing to let himself be executed. And Socrates had similar thoughts, as we know, from the dialogues that we read. The religious impulse, therefore, is, and this needs to be recognized, to deny the reality of evil, is that in the long run, in the totality of God's world, evil cannot be ultimately evil. From Emerson's lecture on the young American, "Gentlemen, there is a sublime and friendly destiny by which the human race is guided. The race never dying, the individual is never spared to results affecting masses and ages. Men are narrow, selfish, but the genius or the destiny is not narrow, but beneficent. It is not discovered in their calculated and voluntary activity. It is not discovered in what men think that they are doing when they are doing what they're doing, but in what befalls, with or without their design. God has his own designs. Only what is inevitable interests us, and it turns out that love and good are inevitable. And in the course of things, that genius has infused itself into nature. It indicates itself by a small excess of good, a small balance in brute facts, always favorable to the side of reason." This is his optimism. This is Emerson's optimism. That is, that the good is inevitable, no matter what the appearances may be. All the facts in any part of nature shall be tabulated, and the raw results shall indicate the same security and benefit, so slight as to be hardly observable, and yet it is there. That is, it's a matter of belief. Of course, Emerson didn't go around throughout the world to see whether or not, as a kind of a census taker, this adds up. But this is a matter of firm belief that always there must be a balance, no matter how slight, a balance in the universe favorable to the good. The census of the population, he cites as an example, the census of the population is found to keep an invariable equality in the sexes, with a trifling predominance in favor of the male, as if to counterbalance the necessarily increased exposure of male life in war, navigation, and other accidents. Remark the unceasing effort throughout nature at somewhat better than the actual creatures. Amelioration in nature, that is, the improvement that goes on, which alone permits and authorizes amelioration in mankind. The population of the world is a conditioned population. These are not the best, but the best that could live in the existing state of soils, gases, animals, and morals. The best that could yet live. There shall be a better, please God. This genius, this destiny, is the sternest administration, though rumors exist of its secret tenderness. It may be styled a cruel kindness, serving the whole, even to the ruin of the member. See, this is again the approach from the whole, looking at the individual from the outside, from the standpoint of the totality. A terrible communist, that's with lowercase communist, reserving all profits to the community, without dividend to individuals. Its law is you shall have everything as a member, but nothing to yourself. We build railroads, we know not for what or for whom. But one thing is certain, that we who build will receive the very smallest share of the benefit, as we always seem to be working for the future generation. Benefit will accrue. They are essential to the country, but that will be felt not until we are no longer countrymen. We do the like in all matters. Man's heart, the almighty to the future, set by secret and inviolable springs. We plant trees. We build stone houses. We redeem the wasteland. We make prospective laws. We establish colleges and hospitals for remote generations. We should be mortified to learn that the little benefit we chanced in our own persons to receive was the utmost that they would yield. We design it thus and thus, it turns out otherwise and far better. This beneficent tendency, omnipotent without violence, exists and works. Every line of history inspires a confidence that we shall not go far wrong, but things mend. This is a typical expression of Emerson's, what we would call optimism, as there's a guaranteed optimism. It's not simply a matter of feeling, but that the universe has built into itself, by God, the operation of laws, which somehow must be operative in a way that the good will be vindicated, even if it's only by a slight balance on its own side. There's the statement in the, I think, St. Paul in the New Testament, the foolishness of men is the wisdom of God. That's what man does, which may seem to be foolish and which is foolish from the short-sighted point of view, for God may be operative as wisdom. In Judaism as well as in Christianity, from this point of view, a man is required to be grateful for the evil that happens to him, as well as for the good. Because what happens to him that appears to be evil cannot be evil if it happens in the world that God has created. So he must be grateful for what appears to be evil, just as he must be grateful for what appears to be good, although actually there may be a reversal of the order, and one never knows, and the religious man is often aware of this, that what appears to be him to be supremely good, and he feels very grateful for what happens, may turn out to be the beginning of a major catastrophe. Because he sees only what's in front of him. And the reverse of that may be equally the case. It's always a matter of lit kindly light amid the encircling gloom. There's a gloom all around us, there's a darkness, and Emerson and the other religious thinkers who think this way have said this time and again in many different ways. And we can take only a small step out of the darkness into an area that is lit up, but we don't know where the next step will take us. So what Emerson rejected here was the nearsighted point of view of an act or of an event. First, because in due time, the event may turn out to be a blessing in disguise. It may enlarge a man's vision, a man's character, though it may appear at the moment to be evil. It may teach him to face or to overcome bigger challenges that may come to him in the future. The moral life requires discipline, and discipline comes often from pain and suffering. And secondly, from the point of view of God, evil may be in fact, or in history, a contribution to good as an element in the moral education of mankind. In The Conduct of Life, one of Emerson's books, he wrote, "There is no chance, no anarchy in the universe. All is system and gradation." As just as that is true of the physical universe, so it is true of the moral universe. From the standpoint of the absolute, everything, as I started out to say, but let me conclude this and show you what James's reaction was to this. From the standpoint of the absolute, everything implicates everything else in the world. There is nothing that is accidental. All things are intertwined. Tennyson expressed this with the reference to the flower in the crannied wall. "But if I could understand what you are, that is this little flower in the wall, root and all in all, I should know what God and man is." As to understand a small thing like a little flower in the wall, to really know it would be to know everything that there is to be known in the universe. Or William Blake's expression of this in his Auguries of Innocence, "To see a world in a grain of sand, as one can see the world in a grain of sand, if one knows how to look at it." Now, one of the chief attractions of Emerson has been that he compels his reader to continually refer the infinite experience, the finite experience, to what has infinite dimensions. So he raises the small experience to the highest possible levels, to see it in its infinite dimensions and its infinite possibilities. This continuous reference to the infinite has the effect of deepening and of heightening the force and the nobility of the finite. And every sympathetic reader of Emerson, I think, is fully aware of how completely, consummately, beautifully Emerson accomplishes this. Now, with this as background, let me turn our attention to William James. There is no break in my discussion. William James was brought up